Welcome back to the Practical Theism Podcast, where faith and culture collide. I'm excited today to have my good friend Louis Lipke on the Practical Theism Podcast today. Louis's been a good friend, a co-worker for a number of years, and we've gotten into various discussions about faith, culture, how they kind of interact and collide with each other. And so I'm really, really grateful to have him on the show. So welcome, Louis.
Thanks. Really, really happy to be here, Josh, and excited to have this conversation with you. And hopefully we can bring some hope to some people and just allow people to understand that there's a lot of nuances to the conversations that we're going to have, and a lot of different ways you can look at it, and not necessarily a right or wrong, but there's room to have discussions about it and talk about it like we're going to.
Oh yeah. And you know what, I think I'm really glad we're going to get into that particular area, because it seems to me like there's such a widespread of obviously belief on this from Christians of all spades, right? And some are like, you have to think this way, and some are like, well, there's open to interpretation. And the crazy part is people just don't know what to, like, which is right. Like, can I have a different interpretation than you on this? And what's interesting is, as we've kind of uncovered in this discussion and our discussions, is there's usually a very kind of commonality, a common starting point when it comes to religion and politics, or faith and politics. So we're in a very apropos time right now, obviously in the throes of the election. There's a lot going on for those who are watching this years down the road. We're in the middle of the 2020 election as we're recording this. And so there's been a whole host of things happening online. Tell us a little bit about your experience with that.
I think hopefully like a few years down the line, if anybody's coming across this, this will just be the year that isn't spoken of.
Yeah. 21. But,
yeah. Right. 2020 didn't happen.
Yeah.
But no, what I've seen online and what I've seen when engaging with people is that there is usually just one of two extremes that is represented.
Yeah.
Represented. And if you don't fall into that extreme, then you're the enemy, right? Mm, you're the bad guy.
Yeah.
My way of thinking is the good, the right way to do it.
Yep.
And if you don't agree with me, then you are. A racist, or you're a communist, or you're a socialist, mm-hmm. or you're a bigot, or whatever it is, right? And we just throw labels on people that disagree with us, and it's a lot of times I see it coming from people who claim to be believers as well, which is what concerns me the most. That's the part that bothers me the most, because one of the things that I really care about and I'm really passionate about is, how do we as the church engage with the world, engage with culture in meaningful ways, to show people what Christ is all about, what God is all about, and what this whole story that we're part of is actually about. And when we do this in the ways that we've been doing it, we turn a lot of people off to Christ, to Christianity. And it's not a good thing. No matter which extreme you fall under, it's not good that we fall on the extremes and we push people away and we label the other people the enemy.
Yeah.
That's not what we should be doing.
It's the antithesis of charity, right? I mean, if you're coming from a religion that claims the utmost charity and the utmost love, and your God, you actually, the God you worship, by the way, is love, right? And we're coming at it with that. It kind of sends a really mixed message to anybody who you potentially want to, you know, evangelize and bring onto your side of the equation. You know, so that's such a good point, a good starting point, because I see the same thing, these polar opposites. You know, it was interesting. I don't know if you've seen The Social Dilemma. It's one of the big Netflix documentaries that just came out.
I haven't dipped my toes in that one yet.
Yeah.
Partially because it's kind of what we do every day.
Yeah, I know.
So I kind of live behind the curtain of that.
Yeah.
And two, because I just don't want to know.
Yeah. You know, it's sad. I had to watch it. I felt like, because I do it every day, I was like, it was probably good for me to see some of the data science behind it. But they have this really interesting graph, particularly when it comes to politics. And they were showing this graph of how the right and the left over the years since 2000 just have gotten further and further away from each other on the issues. And it was just so appropriate for what we're seeing today with this hardcore right wing, hardcore left wing. And like you said, among Christians too. So it's not just like secular society. So let's start here. How do you see faith and politics really overlapping? Where are the overlap points between faith and politics, or should we keep them completely separate?
Yeah, I think if you're part of a society, if you're part of a culture, you're going to have to engage with that culture and that society. And one of the ways that we do that in American culture and a lot of democratic nations is by engaging in politics, engaging in elections. And those are important things to be. I'm never going to tell anyone not to vote. Never going to tell anyone to not be engaged in politics, because it's a very important part of the fabric of our society. I'm also a firm believer that if you don't vote, you don't have a right to complain. And I like to complain, so I'm going to vote. You know, if you're not going to put your voice out there, if you're not going to give your opinion on things and use the right that you have as an American citizen, and like I said, in many other democratic countries around the world, people have that right to speak into what their government is doing. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a good thing. However, what we have seen over the past few decades is the blocking of Christianity into a voter block.
Yeah.
Right? We have become just another voter block to be pandered to when it comes to politics. Politicians, you know, they run on their you know, Christian values and their whatever they're going to throw out there to, you know, to lock in the vote of the church, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we saw, I think, in starting in the 2016 election, that I hadn't really seen before, was the endorsing of candidates from the pulpit, and that was something completely new to me and something I had always kind of grown up to expect to not happen.
Sure.
And to not be a part of what we do on Sundays, on what we do as a church, right? That is something that is states, you know, you can have your opinions politically, but they stay outside of the doors of the church.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we saw shift dramatically with the 2016 election. There's a lot of very passionate feelings behind everything that was going on. Mm. And we saw that barrier kind of broken down, which I think was not a good thing for the church. One of one of my main concerns with the 2016 election is that the church or the evangelical voter,
sure,
which I'm going to use evangelical voter very loosely, because a lot of the people that get thrown into that category are your creasters, right? The people who only go to church on Christmas, right?
Sure.
But they come out of the polls and they say, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. Yeah. Right. And so we get lumped into this block, and there, you know, obviously the big chunk of evangelicals voted for Trump.
Yep.
Which, fine, whatever, you know, I really don't care. But what that did, and in Trump's victory, is it gave legitimacy to some of the more negative things that were going on within that evangelical voting block. Some of the more, honestly, you know, bigoted talks that were happening, some of the more, you know, there was a lot of just kind of negative things that were coming out of the church, quote unquote, right, that were legitimized by the Trump victory. And that was one of my biggest concerns, was that we were going to lose some of our ability to influence the world because of that.
Yeah.
And I think we saw that. I think that's been clear, that the quote unquote evangelical voting bloc has lost a lot of its, you know, the moral majority is not a thing anymore, right?
Yeah.
That is just completely gone. You know, and that, a lot of that started toppling back in the, you know, as far as you can go back to, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and some of the things that were going on there with, you know, the culture wars and, you know, the pushback against the sexual revolution and things like that. And the church, unfortunately, started becoming known for all the things that it's against, right? The church is against this, the church is against that. And, you know, and really this, a lot of this started coming to a head with the election prior to two elections prior to the 2016 election. So what, the 2004?
Yeah.
2008 election. I'm sorry, 2008. The Obama-McCain election.
Yeah.
That was the very first time that I had ever experienced, like, we have to vote Republican because we're Christian.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe it was just because that was the first year that I voted.
Yeah.
But it was the first time I'd really experienced that. And, you know, even then it was a little concerning to me.
Yeah.
That we have this, as a Christians, have this tie to a political party. I didn't really know why it was concerning to me, but as I've developed in my faith and my understanding and my understanding of what being a Christian is actually about,
sure,
like, it's become very clear to me why that was off-putting and a little disturbing to me was because that Christianity is not supposed to be tied to a worldly empire, right? That is not what we're supposed to be tied to. And we've tied ourselves to that over and over again over the past decade. Mm-hmm. And it's, decade or so. And it's caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. You know, it seems too like people... They like you said, they so closely identify Christianity with this idea of Republican. And usually, if you really dig into it with somebody, it oftentimes, I think, comes down to kind of single issue voting.
Yep.
Right. Usually, mm-hmm. I mean, just call a spade, usually it boils down to like an abortion argument. Whichever candidate is anti-abortion, regardless, which is interesting because regardless of whether or not they're anti-euthanasia or anti-death penalty or any of these other life preserving things, long as the candidate's anti-abortion, that's all we care about. And so it's almost like this thing that's been put on this pedestal where we have to associate with one or another, or it's pushed on people to associate with one or another based on that issue. And all of a sudden it becomes, you start the name slinging, even with well-meaning Christians who probably don't even intend to do it or never thought that they would be doing it, but all of a sudden they're doing it. You start name slinging against the person who decides to vote Democrat, right? And all of a sudden they're voting for the Antichrist because this person has abortion all written all over him, right?
Right. I've been made aware of multiple Antichrists throughout my life.
Probably by particular Bono denominations.
Bono was an Antichrist.
Yeah.
Obama was an Antichrist. Hillary was definitely an Antichrist.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, those are all, it's like,
yeah.
I don't know about that. But you kind of hit the nail on the head, though, because, you know, God forbid I start talking about prison reform.
Yeah.
Right? And that being part of a pro-life platform, mm-hmm. or way of thinking, because that is way too liberal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Don't start talking about criminal justice reform or prison reform or the issues with privatized prisons. Don't talk about those things. We're talking about, the killing babies.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. And if you vote for anybody who is for killing babies, you cannot be called a Christian. And I saw that in the 2016 election. I saw people literally saying, if you vote for Hillary, you cannot be a Christian.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, whoa, that is like, that's not something you can say.
Yeah.
You know, because it's there's so many other nuances to all of these things that come into play, and neither party, the Democrat Party nor the Republican Party, truly represents Christian values.
Totally.
Like, they don't. You know, they
I was at, yeah, Christian values are, like, consistently too, right? I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, if you're pro-life, right? But, like, let's just take the pro-life thing. That's always the hot button topic. So pro-life, right?
Yeah.
If you're pro-life,
we'll get lots of angry comments on this because of that.
But. Yeah. If you're pro-life, are you pro-life from conception to natural death? Or are you pro-life from conception until somebody does something really, really wrong? Are you pro-life until somebody's in a vegetative state? Like, there's so many nuances to this idea of being pro-life that people don't explore anything beyond the abortion argument, which I think it's important to explore it, because one of the things I've looked at is like the consistency with which somebody applies a particular line of argumentation. So if they're going to take a particular stance, how consistent are they with that stance across these other things that are going on in the world, regardless of what they are? Exactly.
How far are you going to take your stance? And that's something that I push people on that, and they hate it.
Yeah.
Right.
It depends, Louis. It depends.
Yeah. It's like, okay, well, this is your stance. And now if I took this stance all the way through, it means X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm not for X, Y, Z. I'm just for A.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I'm only for A. But there's 24 other letters of the alphabet. 25 letters in the alphabet? I don't know how many letters in the alphabet.
Yeah.
But there's a bunch of letters in the alphabet that we need to cover here, because your stance, your logic, has to apply universally. Mm-hmm. It can't just apply to your cherry picked issues.
Yeah. Totally.
Right? And that's where we get into trouble when we try to apply Christianity to politics.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not something that was ever meant to be married together.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, clear when we look at history, we look at the things that have gone on, we look at the early church, we look at the teachings of Jesus, we look at the teachings of the early church fathers, right? And it's very distinct that Christianity, that the kingdom of God is separate from the kingdoms of the world.
Yeah.
And it stands in contrast to the kingdoms of the world.
Yeah.
The empire, every empire of the world. And when we see this, you can look, I mean, this throughout scripture, this is clear. You look at Daniel and the, you know, the dreams that Nebuchadnezzar had in Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very clear that this kingdom of God is this, you know, in one of the dreams, it's a stone that rolls down a hill and crushes the statue that represents the kingdoms of, you know, kingdoms of the world, the empires of the world.
Yeah.
It's something that is in contrast to, it cannot ever be in cohesion with the way a worldly empire is built.
Yeah.
And we look back at the way, you know, we can go even farther back into the way, you know, when the nation of Israel was established in scripture.
Yeah.
And the reason for, you know, God choosing a partner in the world,
mm-hmm.
to help bring about his kingdom and the way his kingdom's supposed to be. And you look at the way the kingdom of Israel was set up, and you look at the priesthood and the way the priesthood was set up, right? The priesthood was meant to show Israelites what it meant to be set apart, what it meant to be holy, so that they could live in that way and show the world what it meant to be holy and set apart.
Yeah.
Right. And they failed in that over and over again.
Yeah.
Right. Because they allowed the things of this world to, you know, kind of entice them. You know, they asked for a king when God kept telling them, you know, we don't want to, you know, you don't want this, right? This is not what I want for you. This is not the best way. I have a better way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we still want a king. So he gave him a donkey herder who couldn't even find his donkeys. Like, that was Saul. Like,
yep.
You know, like, which is, I think I heard someone podcast. Guy in a podcast said one time, he goes, like, he gave him a donkey herder because they were acting like donkeys instead of a shepherd because they weren't acting like sheep, right?
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny. But, you know, and then you look at throughout history, you look at, you know, you look at the, I mean, you can go into the Roman Empire, right? And when, you know, Christianity became the kind of national religion of the Roman Empire, and how over time that got really convoluted on who was doing what.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. Was it the church or was it the empire that was doing these things?
Yeah.
Right. And you look at things, you know, and that led to, there's lots of things that came out of that. Like, you know, the great schism, the splitting of the Western and Eastern church, right. There was a lot of politics in play with that that shouldn't have been there. Look at the Reformation, right. And the Reformation initially was not a split, but it was something that was hijacked for political means by the Germanic kings, because they wanted independence from Rome.
Yeah.
Right. You look at the establishment of the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm.
That was all about because, you know, it was Henry.
King Henry VIII. Yeah.
Yeah. Wanted to get divorced again. Right. And he wanted to be kind of independent on his own.
Yeah.
You know, so he just established, oh, we're all just establishing new churches now.
Yeah.
Right. And
it's beauty led of the to monarchy.
This, yeah. Right. And it's just led to this. I mean, look at the church today and how fractured it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot better than it used to be, right? It's a lot better than it used to be. You know, there was a lot of good healing that came about in the 60s. You know, things like the...
At least dialogue was happening, you know, right? You have the Lutheran Catholic Federation that's actually engaged in dialogue over 15th century issues, which, 500 years later, but awesome.
Right? It only took 500 years, but we're working on it.
Yeah.
You know, and things like the reversal of the excommunications by, you know, from between the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Right? There was excommunications that were in place for 500 years, you know, over 500 Crazy. Years, almost 1,000 years. And they finally reversed those things so they could start having dialogue again and start working together.
Yeah.
Right. And like those are good things, but we're still not where we need to be.
Yeah.
Right. You can even, I mean, but politics has played a part in all of these things. When the church gets totally. Too close to the empires of the world and the way that the world operates, it creates problems mm-hmm. because it's not the way the church is supposed to operate.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I want to go back to kind of political party, you know, and this, this right left wing thing that we have going on. And like I mentioned in the beginning, usually it seems like a lot of these issues start from a very similar foundational place. You look at a lot of the left wing type movements towards what they believe is kind of social justice reform. But then you take the right wing of those same issues, which they believe is kind of reform in their own way, or something that doesn't necessarily need to be touched. Not that they would negate the root of what it is, but they go about it in completely different ways. And a lot of people don't even realize that the church, and you see it a lot more formalized, obviously, in the Catholic, more Orthodox churches, this idea of like social teaching, right? You see Jesus's social teaching, you see it a bit more formalized. And like, for example, you have Catholic social teaching, right? And a few of those things are like life and dignity of the human person. That's tantamount to your faith as a believer, is that you have life, you value life and the dignity of the human person. You have solidarity, care for God's creation, call to family, community, and participation, option for the poor and the vulnerable, rights and responsibilities just as a person, dignity of work and rights of workers. These are things that are essential to the faith, whether people know it or not. So you take that first one, life and dignity of the human person, and or even like rights and responsibilities that I personally have, a lot of people don't realize how far the early church potentially took that, especially when it comes to issues of personal property. You know, there's a belief that you had a right to own your own property, but it's, you know, the old saying, it's to the man who has two shirts, one, you know, one belongs to the man who has none, right? So it's, this is integral to kind of faith. So it seems like there's a similar starting point. We want everybody to kind of thrive, but some people go more the route of let's kind of hunker down on capitalism, social, you know, movements in terms of, you know, social policies and things like that for just the general public or the poor. And then the other one is more like social democracy, that we're moving in that direction, which some people confuse as socialism, right? So I used to be that way until I could draw a distinction properly. What's your thought on that, and where are we missing the mark?
Yeah, so I think what we have to understand too, and I think this can go a long way in helping try to repair some of the rift, is that, like you said, we all kind of start from the same place. Right. Like, I think I want to say the majority of people, because not everybody.
Yeah.
The majority of people really, 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 especially let's just look at America. Right. The majority of people in America really just want what's best for the country.
Yeah.
Right. They just want the country to do well and thrive, and they want what's best for everybody. They have different ways of how they think that should happen.
Yeah.
And that's where the split happens. But we have to understand that we're all coming from a pretty common ground.
Sure.
The left, like you said, thinks, you know, a lot of the people on the far left right now think that the government should be the one doting out all the social programs, right? Where the right, not so much, right? And I think one of the problems that we see there is that we as the church have given up our place in the world to the government, right? Who started the first hospitals?
Catholic Church.
The church.
Yeah.
Who started the first orphanages?
Yeah, the church.
The church in response to Roman infanticide, right?
Yep.
And you know, they just throw babies out because they didn't want them, or they weren't a boy, or they weren't a girl, or whatever. They didn't, you know, it was undesirable
for reason
to leave them out in the cold, because you couldn't kill the baby in under Roman law. But if the baby happened to get left outside and died from exposure, and so the church started going around collecting all the babies that were being left outside, and you have orphanages.
Yeah,
right. And that was a way for the church to care for the world and show the love of Christ to the world. What we've done is we've allowed the government to take those things from us.
Yeah,
right. Because it's easier for me just to pay a little bit more in taxes and the government to handle that, so I don't have to do it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of Go ahead.
I was just saying, as we've done that, it's made it, you know, it's made it harder for the church to really have, you know, to have its place in the world, because we've just been
very
loosely, you know, open-handed with our responsibility.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's kind of like we've lost our ability to affect change properly, right? We just kind of turn it over to whatever the government wants. And there's a certain level of like pride and dignity that you have, not in like an evil, malicious sense, but there's a pride that you have being able to be active and take an active role in helping others. And, you know, a lot of it boils back down to obviously a heart issue, right? It's something that's like, you always got to check your heart and your motive for what you're doing and what you're attempting to do. You know, there's some people that I was engaging with online when you talk about some of these social issues, and they're like, I would gladly forfeit 50% of my income to have social democracy. And I'm like, really? 50% of your income? You live in California, for Pete's sake. Like, you're going to be able to do that? Can you sustain? I mean, it's a good, some of it's like, it's a good idea in thought. and in theory, mm-hmm. but practically, how it's practically applied, it seems like it might be not as well thought out, you know?
Yeah, well, and the problem is that there's too many people.
Yeah.
That's really the problem when it comes to things like that. Like, if everybody in this country, every single person of the hundreds of millions of people in America said, I'm willing to give up 50% of my income.
Yeah.
So that way we can have, everybody can have these same things.
Yeah.
Then it would be fine. But that's not going to happen with that many people. You know, it's just not going to happen. Like, you look at some of the, you know, people love to throw out, you know, Sweden and Finland and Norway and Denmark or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, all these countries that have this working socialist government. They really don't. They're capitalist, right? They're more of that.
Or this is the social democracy middle ground that people, you know, are big on. Yeah. Yeah.
Only one of those countries has a population relatively the same as just LA County. And
that's totally.
10 million people. That's where, like, a little over 10 million people is Sweden. The rest of them are under 10 million and close to five and under for a majority of them. And it works because 90% of that society says we're okay with living this way.
Yeah.
Right. And that's fine. That's great. It works for them, but it's not going to work in a place like America because, like we said, we all have different opinions on how it should be done.
Yeah. Works great for me and my wife, you know, it's great for us, me and my wife, you know?
Yeah. You know, and, but the thing is, when we try to look to a political party, when we look to a candidate to fulfill the Christian role in government, they're always going to fall short.
Always.
Right. That's why one of the things that I pushed back against in the 2016 election was that, you know, Trump was the Christian choice. Well, no, he's not really.
Yeah.
Right. But neither was Hillary.
Neither was Hillary. Yeah.
Right. Like there was no Christian choice. Right. The only, you know, there just wasn't. And part of that is because we're not a government dictated by religion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, and we're not a theocracy, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a really good thing because we've seen theocracies in history and they don't work.
Yeah. Define that for me, right? Theocracy. And define that for people who might not be aware of what that is.
Yeah. So a theocracy is a government that is governed by a religion. So you look at some modern day examples of this, and this is a really extreme example, but ISIS, you know, they were looking to establish the caliphate in the Middle East. That caliphate would have been a theocracy because the governing documents of that nation, right, would have been religious documents.
Yeah.
Right. And that it just doesn't work. Like, it doesn't work because not everyone is that religion.
Yeah.
Right. That's another part of that too, is like, when you have a theocracy, when you have a government that's run by a religious text, it then you are now forcing everyone to adhere to that religious text.
Yeah.
When not everyone may believe that religious text is true.
Yeah.
Right. And that's like, you know, and we know that, like, I you could grab 20 people off the street and, you know, talk, hey, is the Bible true? And there's going to be a good chunk of them that say no.
Yeah.
Right. And so why do I expect them to live by the same moral standards that I do as a Christian?
Yeah.
Right. And that's another area we've messed up in the past few decades as a church, is we want to use policy. We want to use laws to push our moral standards on the rest of the country, when the rest of the country doesn't claim our moral standards.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you take, that's a big thing with the LGBTQ rights. Right. And honestly, from a legal governmental standpoint, there's no reason that homosexual people should not be able to get married.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then even in the church, it's up for debate on whether or not that's something that the Bible even teaches. Right. But we wanted to use, yeah, I remember how many people were just so upset when the Supreme Court allowed, you know, said that this was a right, right? For homosexual marriage was a right and should be allowed across the board. How many Christians just wept at that and thought, oh man, this country's gone down the drain.
Yeah.
Like, a lot. I mean, at least people I knew, like, I ran into people that were like telling people, like, oh, if you change your, you know, your profile picture to a rainbow on social media, just unfriend me. And I'm like, oh, that's loving. Right. Like, that's what Jesus would do. Yeah. But that's like, but we can't do that because not everyone, like, not everyone in this country is a Christian.
Yeah.
Newsflash, right? You know, but we, so that's the dangers of trying to, you know, we try to use policy to push our own moral agendas on people, and it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It pushes people away.
Yeah. So you would be against the theocracy for a lot of those reasons.
100%. I just, and back to the, you know, my statements earlier is that because the kingdom of God, the kingdom that Christ established,
yeah,
that he is reigning over today, is not a worldly kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It is not. It's not. And it's going, you know, and it stands in contrast to the empires of the world. And mm-hmm. as soon as you start governing, as soon as you start, you know, there's going to be war. There's going to be, you know, all these negative things that come with that. And all, a lot of those things are, you know, fly in the face of Christianity.
Yeah.
And what we're supposed to be about in the world. And it just doesn't work out.
Yeah.
So,
definitely.
But yes, I would be 100%. So that's like, I would be against a Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's a theocracy, if in case anyone wanted to, that's an extreme version of it. That's an extreme fundamentalist Christian theocracy.
And you know, when you look at it too, you know, even if you take the Christian God, for example, right, he's not one that, is intending, like, you still made, well, depending on what, I guess, Christian circle you come from, right? Whether or not free will exists, but you come into this with free will, right? If humans innately have free will, then they have the choice to choose something or not choose another thing. And so if you come into it from a theocracy standpoint where you're pushing down the throat to the people through your political agendas, exactly what whatever your religion kind of states as factual or as belief, then, or whatever your religion states that, then all of a sudden you get into kind of some pretty dicey waters of imposing this belief versus proposing it, making it something that's freely chosen, right? But you know what they say? Go ahead.
I was bringing back to the abortion thing, right? Like, we have, you know, and I don't believe in, I don't believe abortion is right. I don't think that's just that's my personal opinion. I understand there's nuances to it. Abortion should be illegal.
Yeah. See, I was just going to say that. Like, that's where my mind goes. And I'm like, huh, it gets your noggin turning a little bit to, okay, do you make a law? Have you had some conversations about this? Do you make a law enacting something like that? Right. From a legal standpoint, obviously, I'm pro-life, right? I'm against abortion 100%. Is it, and I'm just posing the question, not as a personal thought, but is it right to have the state make a law ruling that out because it is necessarily what I hold to be true? And I think where you get into that now, this is the conservative side of that argument, right? Go to the other side. If we want to be consistent with that logic, it's got to apply to this other side as well, too. It can't be somebody who's saying, well, no, because I believe abortion, then it necessarily has to be enacted by law that people have the ability to get an abortion. Because then you're kind of on the opposite side, same problem, right? But I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? That's something that's rattled my brain a little bit.
Yeah. My reasoning behind that, I'm anti-abortion.
Yeah.
I don't believe abortion is a human right. I don't think so. I don't think that's just because I see life as starting from conception. There's a lot of people out there that would disagree with me, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I would also not be for a law against abortion because I'm pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you outlaw something like that, a very complex, dangerous medical procedure, you're going to go back alley coat hanger abortions, and women are going to start losing their lives because of it, right? And that's a problem. That's not pro-life. So and I also don't think it's pro-life to try to enact punishment on people for having an abortion. I don't think that's okay either. So And part of it too is because something like abortion is not something that's going to be solved by policy.
Sure.
It's a personal.
It's a heart thing.
Conviction. It's a heart thing, right? And
yeah,
standing outside of an abortion clinic with a sign that says, you know, you're going to hell or murderer, that's not solving the problem either,
yeah,
right? And, no. You know, that's not okay either. And shaming people who get it. And, you know, but, you know, it's such a complicated issue because there's a lot of emotion tied up in it.
Totally.
Right. There's, and we've come to these extremes on it, right? Where if you're against, there's a lot of people out there that hear me say, I'm against abortion. And what they hear is I'm against women's health rights.
You're against women who've been raped, Louis. Let's just go straight to it.
Which I'm not. I understand there's a lot of really complicated circumstances surrounding abortion, right? That there is, you know, there's a lot of that. And I have deep compassion for people that are in those situations.
Yeah.
I would never, ever tell one of them what to do with that. That's your personal thing.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why I'm against the law that says you can't do that. Right. I would love for you to keep that baby. But on the other side of it, back to the church, what are we doing to support the women who do keep the baby?
Sure.
Right. What are we doing? We're not, you know, we're not doing enough. We do some, but we're not doing enough. I saw a stat a few years ago, and I would have to fact check it, but
sure.
I think I did it at the time and it was about right. But that there was about, it was a few years ago, so these numbers may be off now. But there was about 450,000 kids in the foster care that were eligible for adoption in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There were also right around 450,000 churches in the United States. If each church pulled their resources and adopted one of those children, there would be no more orphans in the United States.
Yeah. Crazy.
You know, that's, but it would take that because adoption is expensive. It's ridiculously expensive to adopt.
100%.
It's not easy. Right. And so those are other things that we need to address is how do we fix the adoption system? How do we fix the foster care system?
Yeah.
Right. If we're going to be pro-life, then we need to go tackle those things too.
Totally.
Right. We can't just be against abortion. We have to be pro reform in these other areas because we're not making it easy for the people who do keep the baby. And abortions are down, by the way.
Yeah.
Just as a fun fact, abortions are down.
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago, I saw another stat that was crazy because, you know, we always want to talk about abstinence and waiting till marriage as ways to solve the abortion issue. 50% of the people who got abortions were married.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. I saw that. Yeah.
What do you do with that?
Now, what's interesting, you know, what do you too, when you look at those stats too, the largest percentage of abortions too are from low income, poverty stricken families. So people who feel like they can't actually support a child. And so there's, again, you're pointing out a lot of really good points of these are issues that we need to talk about and address. It's not just something that solves with, hey, just stop abortions. It seems to be there's more nuance to support that needs to be had in order to lessen that number, if that makes sense.
And what a great place that would be for the church to step in.
Yeah.
And not say you're condemned because you got an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But we're here to support you in whatever way we can. Right? We're here to show you the love of Jesus.
Yep.
We're here to show you that what you do or what you have done is not, you're not condemned for that, but you're accepted into a family that loves you.
Yeah.
Right. And there is a God that loves you and there is a Savior that gave his life for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, what a great place for us to be able to step in and do that. But instead we're known for being against those people.
Yeah.
Right. And condemning those people.
Yeah.
And that breaks my heart. And I believe that it breaks the heart of Christ as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for all those churches out there who have in their mission statement, we want to get back to being what the church was like in the first century. This is what the church is like in the first century. Going and picking up the slack where people need support and actually take care of babies. Bingo.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just, I think it's such a complicated issue. And I hope that anybody who's into this that disagrees with me on abortion knows that I don't hate you for that.
Yeah.
I don't think you're evil for that. And that I love you regardless of that.
Yeah.
Right. Regardless of our disagreement. And that's one of the things that we need to get back to as well, is loving people regardless of our disagreements with each other.
Yeah. And really,
like you and I have, we have conversations. We don't always agree on things.
No, not at all.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm one of those, you know, rebellious Protestants, and you're a Catholic and, you know, and, you know, but we don't always agree on certain things, but we still care for each other. We still love each 100%. Other. We still respect each other.
And we're both, both seeking the truth. We're both trying to figure this thing out with the limited finite knowledge that we have, and ultimately trying to walk in the spirit the best way that we know how. And you know what? That's all you can ask for someone. You know, there was a C.S. Lewis quote, I think it was a Mere Christianity, where he talks about pretty much like the dude from Bel Air versus the dude from the slums, and saying how they're going to be judged differently, and how the challenges that somebody from the slums faces is not the challenges that somebody from Bel Air is going to face. And the dude from Bel Air should not be looking at the guy from the slums, holding him to the same standard that he would hold necessarily somebody who had all he had, and vice versa. So we got to stop looking at people and evaluating them on whether or not they're doing things how we would do them or how we would think. Rather, we need to step back. We need to recognize when somebody's from Bel Air or when somebody's from the slums, and approach them and uncover with them about all the things that make them different and unique, and all the biases that they have kind of built in and into their thinking and their logic, and understand really where they're coming from. But that requires patience, and that requires love, that requires humility, that requires charity. And you have to put that forward, because the world's not used to seeing that. The world's not used to seeing that. They're used to seeing the divisive, angry, rioting from both sides of the equation, hateful, spiteful people that are just spinning the world into this negative spiral. And we have to get out of that. And it starts with you being able to walk in your circle of influence and be the light in the world, which again is a Christian kind of fundamental belief core to the faith, you know?
Right. And I love the parable where Jesus tells about the city on the hill,
mm-hmm.
right? That we're supposed to be a city on a hill, because a city on a hill is a place of refuge. It's a place of safety. It's a place of provision, right? It meant a place to stay, a place to rest, food to eat for the travelers that were on the road. And we as the church, as followers of Jesus, are supposed to be like a city on a hill to the rest of the world, right? Not a city on a hill that shuts its gates and keeps the people out, but a city on a hill that welcomes everybody in and says, you're loved and you're cared for, and we're here to, you know, take care of you and provide for you.
Yeah.
And we do that because of Jesus, and because of what he taught, and because of the way that we're supposed to live. Right. And we genuinely love you, and we're not just doing it because we're told to do it. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, that's what we're supposed to be. And it's not what we are right now in a lot of ways.
Totally.
Especially in America. And I'm very much speaking to America itself. I cannot speak. The believers in China, man, they do amazing things. They do incredible things.
Yeah.
Right. Believers all over the world who live in persecuted places, who live in places that literally are life and death for them. And we have this, you know, privilege to kind of sit back and mull over whether or not Christians should be involved in politics, right?
Yeah.
While there's people out there who are literally giving their lives for the faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we as Western Christians really need to pick up the slack a little bit, and stop getting sucked into these extremes and name calling and labeling people the enemy, because pretty sure Jesus said to love your enemies.
Yeah.
Right. And to bless those who curse you. And we don't do that. We get sucked into the name calling. We get sucked into the mudslinging, and we need to be above that. We need to be above it and be a witness to the love of Christ in the world. And getting overly engaged in politics is not the way to do that.
Totally.
To bring it back to kind of the topic at hand, right, is when we tie ourselves to a political party, we alienate the other half of the country.
Yeah.
Right. When we stick our flag on this hill of conservatism, whatever, or liberalism, right? And we stick our flags there, and that's where the hill we're going to die on.
Yeah.
Like that's not what we're supposed to be doing as Christians. You can have your beliefs one way or the other honestly, be a liberal Christian, be a conservative Christian. I don't care. Right. But don't, that's not the end all be all for you as a Christian, because the end all be all for you as a Christian is you are a citizen of the kingdom of God, and that you are supposed to be a representative of the kingdom of God to the world. And that kingdom of God lives in contrast and operates in contrast to the kingdoms of the world.
Yeah. Good point. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say you're a Christian before you're a Republican or a Democrat. So don't ever forget that. Louis, this has been awesome.
I'm an independent.
Yeah. Or you're before you're an independent, a Green Party, or, or you choose not to vote and you're just a minor. Yes. All right. So good, Louis, this has been awesome. Really appreciate your time jumping into this. You know what? We're going to have to obviously continue this, I think probably in a part two at some point, because there's just so much here. You know, I think we focused on a particular facet of the political
discussion. We didn't even talk about race issues.
No.
That are going on.
And you know,
that's a whole other can of worms.
It totally is. It's probably a completely different episode. We should just do in its own right. But the reality that like the whole civil rights movement is born out of the church, you know, and whether or not people realize that or not, I think they may have forgotten that that was the case.
There's a great, great video of Matt Chandler just losing his mind on his congregation.
Yeah.
About civil rights. Yeah. And the you know, racial injustice, and it's like he's the only person I'm like, yeah, yell at me, I want you to yell at me. Yeah. Like, I love when he yells. But he makes some really good points in that, and there's a lot of things to unpack there as well, like that we've seen going on this year.
Yeah.
And again, that's a place that the church has allowed, has opened its hand and allowed that issue to be taken away.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. All right, Louis. Well, I appreciate your time, man. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. We'll catch you soon. All right.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lou. And for everybody listening, wherever you might be listening at, definitely hit that like button, pound that subscribe button like you mean it, so you can continue to get more of this awesome content, and ring that little bell so you get notifications in your inbox when we're posting new stuff over here at the Practical Theism podcast channel. From all of us here, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.